Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Meanwhile, please enjoy this encore presentation of Real Vision content.
Hi, I'm Nathan Egger from Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Television encore presentation, we're bringing you The Reset 2, which happens to be the most popular piece in Real Vision's history. It was originally released February 19th of this year. You'll be hearing this discussion between Grant Williams and Raoul Paul. They are the co-founders of Real Vision and both friends and past guests of Macro Voices. They're going to attempt to bring some clarity to an increasingly complex macroeconomic picture. I hope you all enjoy this week's Real Vision Television encore presentation.
Welcome, everybody. This is a special interview that I'm going to do. We've been speaking a lot about some of the stuff that's been going on, and we started a little over a year ago with me talking to Raoul about a piece he wrote called The Endgame. And we ended up doing two pieces on this, The Endgame and The Reset. And I thought it was a great chance for us to come back and revisit those because things are moving very, very fast now. And the genesis of this was a piece Raoul wrote a few weeks ago in mid-January, an update to his subscribers, which he called The Black Swan, in which he pointed out the speed with which the banking system, particularly in Europe, was unraveling. As we've seen in the days and weeks since then, it's become a major problem. So I figured that Raoul and I could sit here and talk a little bit about that and a little bit about the whole point behind Real Vision, which was at times like these to try and educate people, help them understand what's going on and why things that seem so out of control are actually happening. You know, none of this is stuff that wasn't seen by people. So Raoul's here with me, and we're going to sit down and maybe talk about a few of these things. Raoul, so you and I get the chance to sit around the office and kick this stuff around every day, which is great. But when you put the piece out about the Black Swan, it pricked up a lot of ears. I mean, we had a bunch of people calling the office. You were on the phone all the time. Just talk a little bit about what the Black Swan said, and then we can kind of kick around some of the possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, I had been writing a lot about various parts of what's going on in the economy, and I've been quite public about it. You know, whether it's on Twitter, and I've appeared on CNBC and obviously on Real Vision talking about the law of unintended consequences. And that was the talk about the dollar, what's happening to the bond market and the possibility that rates are going to fall dramatically, what was happening in emerging markets, what was happening in oil, what was happening in commodities, what was happening kind of in the global economy. And I had been keeping my eye on some of the European banks because I always start with the charts, and the charts of stuff like Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse didn't look right to me. And I've been writing about this for about a year, just saying, listen, I don't really know. I know Deutsche Bank has 70 trillion of derivatives on their books, more than 100% of global GDP. So I thought, you know, I need to keep an eye on this. And then suddenly, in early January, I started flicking through the charts again, and I had that holy shit moment when I suddenly saw all of the banks were going, and they're in free fall. I don't know how much Deutsche Bank's fallen in the last couple of months, but it's 50% or something crazy. At that point, I started realizing this is much bigger than I thought, and this was the black swan that nobody was looking at, because everyone's looking at China, everyone's looking at the dollar, everyone's looking at EM, the oil markets, and suddenly the European banks are collapsing.
How does this sneak up on everybody? Because it kind of caught everybody by surprise.
This is probably the purest global macro environment I've ever seen in my working career, and probably since the 1930s. So there's only a few of us who really do global macro and live and breathe it, and it's what I do. But what I know in this kind of environment, it's really complex. There's lots of moving parts. They all happen at once and they're all interconnected. And it's a skill set that's just different in how we do things. So it's this enormous puzzle. So most people aren't used to doing that. They're used to following news flow as opposed to anticipating news flow. And in these kind of global macro situations, it's about anticipating news flow. And that's where charts come so useful, because you can suddenly flick around the world and say, okay, what is going on here?
But we're talking about the banking sector, right? Which has been the epicenter of the previous crisis, should have everybody focused on it. how does Deutsche Bank go down 30%? How does Credit Suisse break multi-year support without there being headlines until that waterfall accelerates?
It's because of the hubris of central banking. Because if the central bankers tell you it's okay, the market's got a Pavlovian response to believe it's okay. Now, I think why I wanted to do this as part of the reset is because part of the idea behind the reset, at some point, central bankers are proven not to be omnipotent. And I think that's the process we're going through. You know, as we're speaking, the BOJ are having tremendous problem trying to actually get the currency to do what they want it to do, or the stock market to do what they want it to do. And this is the kind of thing that is going to materialize. So everybody believed that the European situation was fine because they told you it was fine. And everybody does the wrong thing, which is look at growth now and not forward-looking growth. So if you look at the business cycle, which I use, it tells you it's rolling over. But people take a snapshot and say, the European economy's fine. The banks will be fine. Uh-uh. And not when you've got emerging markets going under. So that puts pressure on places like Santander, who have huge emerging market exposure. Then they've obviously got oil exposure because they're exposed to Brazil and these other countries. And that whole thing triggers all sorts of events. And then there was the stunning situation. It is another law of unintended consequences, where some bright spark came up with the idea of cocoa bonds.
Right. Well, okay, great. Great thing to bring up, because we hear a lot about these cocoa bonds in the last couple of weeks. People have kind of figured out that these might have something to do with what's going on. So for the people that don't understand what they are, just explain a little bit of how they work, because they are very interesting instruments.
Yeah, and they're really complicated. I cannot profess to know a great deal of the detail, because they're all different. But it came to me, it was a conversation you and I had had in a bar here in Grand Cayman, and I woke up in the middle of the night and went, holy shit, it's the cocoa bonds. And I think I was the first person. I went on Twitter that day and said, I don't know anything about these, but I have a feeling that this is really wrong. And then I got a lot of feedback, fantastically, back about the cocoa bonds. And then I realized, yeah, I was right. That gut feeling that I had was that these looked like something we saw in the late 90s, which is called reverse convertibles. And essentially, what it is in reverse convertibles, there were yield enhancements. So you get a bond, and they basically sold puts in the downside of the stock market. And it looks great because you get this extra yield, which is the sale of the put. Obviously, if the market goes down, you'll short the market. And there's a ton of hedging that gets done. And cocos are similar, but much more complex, because they're based on the tier one capital ratios. So the idea was, in theory, by whoever the bright spark was that if the tier one capital starts drawing down and getting near its limit, these cocos would issue either new equity, so you get put into equity, so it's a convertible, so they're called contingent convertible bonds, or some of the cocoa extinguishes itself, so the debt amounts reduce, so it balances the whole thing. But what it means is, everyone said, well, this is not a share price thing, it's based on T1 capital. Well, T1 capital is based on the share price. The whole thing is all wrapped up in the same thing. So basically what it means is, if you were one of the smart guys who bought the cocoa bonds and you'll have made some return for a period of time, great. But what you do, because it was very smart people who bought them, because you can't understand them otherwise, is that you have to be able to hedge them. So how do you hedge a cocoa bond? Well, initially, when you're a long way away from the tier one capital kind of put, what you do is you might trade some CDS around it. So that's what people did. They traded a couple of CDSs, particularly the iTrax financial CDS, and it was fine. But then when it starts moving towards the strike, it then turns into an equity. And this is the bit that nobody realized. So what happens is, anybody who's got these things has to start selling stock. And you're basically, the market is in a negative gamma situation. And that kind of negative convexity means that people were not prepared for that. And what it does is, as opposed to saving the bank, it pushes the share price lower and pushes it to a bankruptcy. So this is just accelerating the process. I mean, the banks were bad anyway, but then you've got this ridiculous instrument. Now, the question is, what happens? I mean, do the ECB come in and try another QE where they buy the cocoa bonds, take them as collateral? I mean,
well, it's Deutsche Bank. This is the point, right? They will have to do something. They can't, this isn't Lehman, right? They can't let Deutsche Bank go.
No.
So they'll have to do something.
And, you know, I get misinterpreted. When I say they're all going to zero, what I mean is they're going to be taken over. Right. They're going to be bailed out, basically.
Yeah.
But, you know, essentially, equity holders are going to lose their money, and who knows how many of the bondholders will too.
But you brought up the central bankers, and I think this has been the moment I've been waiting for. This was, to me, the tipping point was always going to be when that faith in central bankers evaporated. And I don't think it's quite evaporated yet, because they haven't made their move to counter this. They're going to have to do that fairly soon. But one of the most instructive things I've seen was the market's immediate reaction to Kuroda taking rates negative in Japan. You know, the Nikkei fell 900 points in the space of a matter of minutes, straight after that. And then the spin came out, and you know, stories were on Bloomberg about saying how it was a great thing and it wouldn't, you know, this was going to really help Abenomics. And the market bounced and it kind of got up. But you saw that it's those moments where you see knee-jerk reaction, unfettered, unspun. What does it want to do? And the market wants to go down.
And again, that was an unintended consequence because people didn't think through what it means to the banking sector.
Right.
So what they're thinking is, well, if we go to negative rates, it's going to get cash back into the system because people are going to spend money. And the same old stupid things they keep trying. But what happens with negative rates, it becomes virtually impossible for banks to return,
particularly,
earn a return.
Particularly when you've taken away their ability to trade, which Dodd-Frank's essentially done.
Right? That's right.
So you've crippled these institutions. I mean, if you look at the European banking system, negative rates, look at the banks. Look at Japan, look at the banks, negative rates. Now people are saying, well, the Fed are going to be the next ones. We've seen the Riksbank go out to 4.5% this morning. If the US go to negative rates, which seems a long way away, but these things will happen very quickly, the US banking system is going to come under the same kind of pressure.
Yeah, and the share price of Citibank are already falling. Some of the US banks look terrible as well. Some of the UK banks look terrible. The market's starting to understand that there is almost no way out of this, which is what we talked about originally when we talked about the reset. I mean, the only thing that we don't know is the time. And we don't know the machinations in the middle, but we kind of know where it's all going. And it's following the path. We know the next thing to come is negative rates elsewhere. We know there's going to be a ban on cash, which is a terrifying thing, but it's coming. Then we also know, and these are things we talked about a year and a half ago, we also know that there are wealth taxes to come to try and desperately claw back income. We know that's to come too. There are so many of these issues. I think there's going to be a QE for the people, which will be not for the 1%, but for the 99%. What will that be? That'll be building roads and bridges financed by quantitative easing, also the using the Fed's balance sheet. I mean, I don't know how this ends, but it cannot end well in this situation.
There was a really interesting interview on CNBC. Carl Bass appeared last week while we were at the conference here, and he was talking to David Faber. And you know, they're obviously friends, and so it was a good conversation. It was a bit of give and take in it. And at one point, David Faber said to Carl, you know, you had this big bet on Japan, and you spoke about this, you spoke about the bonds, and you spoke about the currency, and it didn't happen. And right there, I'm thinking, you know, didn't is not the same as hasn't. And this is what I struggle to come to terms with. People assume that because something hasn't happened, it won't happen, and it didn't happen.
That's a really important point, because one of the reasons you and I set up Real Vision was because we thought people really needed to get a true understanding of what's going on, because these are extraordinary times, and the risks are extraordinary, and the opportunities will be too. But it was, people needed to know. And the problem is, for you and I, we go out on a limb to do this, because it's a very awkward situation for me, because you know, I always kept myself private, but I've had to become more public in what I'm doing, because I think it's important for us. We have a moral duty, I know that sounds a big term, a moral duty to get across a message to people that, you know, things are bad. So it's tough when I go on television or on Real Vision or write to my subscribers and say, I think a lot of these banks are going to zero. Now, I'm not doing that for sensationalism in any way. I just think people need to be aware that there is a reasonable probability. And I don't deal in certainties, I only deal in probabilities. And I'm not going to say this unless I think there's a reasonable probability. And so it's really important to get this stuff across to people. And I know it sounds sensationalist, but you know, this is why we've got Real Vision.
You and I sat through 08, we watched all this stuff happen. And you know, as you said, that's a large reason of how we ended up doing this thing in the first place, because there was this sense that, you know, how could we have seen it coming? And we're sitting here, The Big Short is playing about the four or five guys who made out like bandits during the financial crisis, because they were the only ones smart enough to see it coming. It's not, you know, it's not the case. And it's certainly not the case today. You know, now it seems to me there are even more smart people paying attention, but they're getting drowned out by this need of central bankers trickling down to mainstream media to sell this positive story that everything's been fixed and it's all fine and it's all, you know, everything's going to grow and it's going to fix itself. It's not going to fix itself. It can't fix itself because of the debt.
Yeah, and I think we need to put ourselves in the shoes of the central bankers. Given the same set of circumstances, how would you deal with it? It's difficult to say that you would have done much different. Yeah, we'd all like to say, I'd press the reset button. But it's not an easy thing to do when you're in charge, you know, you're looking after the financial resources of a country of 350 million people. You know, I wouldn't want to do that. And so they're going to fight to the death. And that fighting to the death is all they're doing is trying to suppress volatility. And as we've talked about many times, suppress volatility leads to hyper-volatility. And that is what we've got going on now. We've got the volatility genie popping out of every bottle right now, whether it's China, and the Chinese have their own volatility genie to deal with. The Japanese look like they've just been given theirs on a plate as well. We know that's happened in the energy markets and the commodity markets. It's happening in the European banking system, and it's happening in the global economy. And then it's happening in emerging markets. Now, obviously, there's one big country missing in that equation, which is the US, yeah. And the volatility genie is going to come.
Yeah, look, as sure as night follows day. But you know, when you talk about what would you do in that situation, the disconnect I find is these guys, look at Bernanke, for example, who was a great student of financial history. And a lot of what he did in 08 was driven by his deep understanding of the Depression and the work he'd done on that. But there's a point where, I mean, you can take this all the way back to Greenspan to find, in my views, the original mistakes. You know, Greenspan's monetary policy was way too easy for way too long when it didn't need to be. And that kind of set this thing in motion. Because once you get markets used to a certain reaction, you mentioned Pavlov earlier on, it's exactly right. Markets expect lower rates, more stimulus whenever they start to buckle. You know, TARP, QE1, whatever you want to call it, fine. I don't think anyone really has a problem with that. You could argue the mechanics of it and how you could have got the money into better hands or whatever. But when you get into QE2 and you get into Operation Twist and you get into QE3, which all looked optically, whether they were or not, it's hard to rewrite history. They all happened after what were, in essence, small falls in the stock market, perfectly healthy corrections in the stock market, and they leapt in to do this. Now, either they saw this coming, they saw something really bad and felt that was the way to stave this thing off, in which case, now what do? Or they were just playing the music that the market wanted to hear, which is certainly what it looked like optically. What do they do? Because these markets want to go down. That's clear. They want to find a clearing price. I don't see how you can stop that when you've got rates at zero without getting cash bans and all the kind of things that are almost Orwellian in nature.
Yeah, and banning of short selling and right. All of that stuff. We don't know is the answer. We just don't know how they can deal with this once the market takes the decision that the central banks have to do a lot more. They haven't tried the fiscal stimulus route since TARP, really. So if they do say, right, we're going to build bridges and do all the US airports and all that stuff that needs to get down the roads, you know, is that going to be, the Keynesians are going to be jumping up and down saying, this is it, this is what we need, right? Because this is the thing that has not been proven yet. So we need to go and blow up that, you know, we need to have the bonfire of that vanity as well.
Right.
Only then will we realize that in the end, you know, we are just part of the business cycle. And if you create a debt super cycle, you get a debt super cycle bust. People can understand it intuitively in commodities.
Right.
You get a commodity super cycle bust, because it's been going on forever. But the credit cycle is so big and people don't understand. They get confused with all of the elements that it creates around them that they don't really know. And history has told us that it's almost impossible to manage. Japan was bloody lucky in how it managed its debt super cycle bust because the rest of the world was still growing. So you had a cushion. Right now, there's nobody growing.
That's such an important point. That whole idea that, because people say, well, you know, Japan was the second biggest economy in the world and they've been through 20 years of deflation and it didn't hurt. Yeah, because you had genuine growth elsewhere. Now, where's the growth coming from? It's not coming from Europe. It's not coming from the US, really.
That's right. And if you look at, like a lot of people say, well, this could be just 1998 again, i.e. a non-event for the US. The US market fell 20%. Germany fell 30, 35%. So it was a reasonable event. Some of the banks, like Credit Suisse, got into deep trouble again that time around. But the US is growing at 4.5%
right. In
1998. This time around, it's barely growing at all. And so, you know, the chances of something bad happening, and I've been talking about the business cycle for some time, and I still owe Real Vision viewers the business cycle presentation, but I'm so swamped with everything going on, I will do it.
We'll get there.
But now, if you look at all of the business cycles everywhere in the world, they're all pointing negative. So, you know, and I've always written that in a recession, bad things happen. The big ugly comes out. And within this process of heading towards the reset or the end game, we know what the big uglies are. We just don't know how ugly they are and in what order they come. Which is why the European banks, you know, was always one of them. And the whole banking sector still is. The US banks are still not great either. Everyone, there's a narrative. You'll listen to the narrative. The drums get beaten. No, the US banks have been recapitalized. They're fine. That's bullshit. There's still a lot of problem in the US banking system. It is not cleared up. So the thing that really concerns me is the fact that the liquidity from the system, or the illiquid assets from the system, have gone to only very few liquidity providers. And that's BlackRock, Carlyle, Fortress, Apollo, etc. Those guys now own all the illiquid assets. They've taken what the banks were doing before and taken it and concentrated it even more so. And that terrifies me because the liquidity situation has changed dramatically. This is probably the worst liquidity situation I have ever seen. The global marketplace is now like the emerging markets were in 1998. It's huge air pockets because there are no natural buyers of assets right now. We've got the sovereign wealth funds who are natural sellers of assets. They were the big provider of liquidity. The pension system is going to get into true trouble. It's going to have to sell assets to realize anything. Otherwise, they've got the funding black holes. So they're a net seller of assets. Demographically speaking, they are too. The banks who were liquidity providers, that was their job in the system, are now not there. So the only guys who provided liquidity are basically funds that are subject to the same liquidity that's coming out of the sovereign wealth funds, who are the biggest investors in these. So if the pension system, sovereign wealth system, start trying to liquidate BlackRock, there is no buyer of those assets, or Blackstone, there's no buyer of those assets in the world. So this terrifies the hell out of me.
If you think about what QE has been about, it's been about liquidity, about injecting liquidity into the system. We keep hearing that expression. So how, you know, when you talk about the law of unintended consequences, liquidity begets illiquidity. And obviously, what do you do now? If you've pumped in $4.5 trillion just from the Fed, plus the Bank of England, plus the BOJ, plus the ECB, plus the Chinese, which, I mean, that number, who knows what it is, but we know it's many magnitudes higher than it's supposed to be. What do you do? Like, what's the solution to that?
Well, firstly, liquidity is a misunderstood concept. And what's happened is you've seen around the world velocity of money collapsing. It's utterly collapsed in the US, and it's happened everywhere. So what's happening is money has no particular value within the general population. They don't want to use it. It does not circulate. So it's being hoarded. So that's telling you something is structurally a mess. And also, you know, all of this excess liquidity, it did provide too much liquidity to places like these illiquid liquidity providers. And that has been a concern. This is the 1% in the general public terms, abusing the fact that there's cheap money around to buy as much cheap assets as they could, and to the detriment of almost everybody else, because nobody else could get money.
So, well, let's talk about potential outcomes. You know, there's a good scenario, there's a base case, there's an extreme scenario. Let's talk about potentially a smooth unwinding of this. What does that look like?
The smooth unwind is not going to be smooth. It'll have, much like we've seen from 2012, we saw 2012, you get to the precipice, they manage to do something that's enough to stick over the hole, and you hope that they can do that without the whole system collapsing. It came very close in 2012. So they can keep doing this a number of times. The system is saved from failure, but each time is incrementally better. You know, that's kind of a bit like Japan, but with more volatility. That's possible. And I think that's the inherent belief in central banks. And maybe they are right. You know, what do you and I know, right? There's a lot of smart people who will also say, you know, the central banks can sort this out. There is still a belief in economics as some, you know, voodoo magic. So that's possible. So that's, for me, the smoothest route.
So, but base case, I mean, if you had to, you deal in probabilities, what's the most probable outcome that you see for this?
Sadly, and again, I'm not wanting to sound sensationalist, but I think the most likely outcome, as I've said since the last time we spoke in this format over a year and a half ago, is in the next recession, one of the big uglies comes out. It's going to be, and I don't know which one it is. It's a race between China and a 50% deval versus a total collapse internally of their economy because of their credit bubble. Whether it's Japan, which we've all been looking and waiting for, and it hasn't happened, but maybe it happens. Or maybe it's the European banking sector forcing the hand of everybody else, and suddenly all the collateral in the system's worthless again because the European government's bonds are worthless again. We all think that went away. It didn't go away at all. Whether it's just the loss of central bank control over the monetary system. Whether it's, I mean, one of the beliefs that I still have, even though the dollar is correcting somewhat now, is I still think the dollar wildly overshoots in this environment and the problems that that causes and a Plaza Accord, and then maybe some debt jubilee and debt forgiveness that needs to happen. There's a whole host of things. It's almost impossible to know which one it is. But what we need to care about is not trying to spot the one. It's about, is there going to be a domino effect?
Right, which when you run through all those as possibilities, the linkage between them is really clear. I mean, you don't have to stretch to figure out how one knocks the other one out.
And when the world is not awash with capital, when it is very badly liquidity constrained, when there are no liquidity providers and there are massive air pockets in all sorts of assets, if one of those goes, I mean, it is going to be extraordinary.
Well, let's. I mean, it seems to me that the base case and the extreme case are pretty close. I mean, it doesn't get much worse than that, right? We're going to see an awful lot of bad things happen.
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind, however, there's still the business cycle. And the business cycle will bottom out over the next 18 months or so. And therefore, maybe we can get away this time before the business cycle rolls back up again. I think each time the business cycle is going to get more and more subdued. So maybe we get away with it. It's possible. I just don't know. But all I know is my spidey sense is up. My radars are all bleeping and looking around at every single thing possible because I'm terrified that one of these is going to go off.
Well, and the danger in making we might be okay your base case is not a sensible risk to take, well, right?
Yeah. The fear in that for me, and one of the reasons I wanted to do this, is the fear in that for me is it creates a sense of I don't need to do anything. Inactivity.
Precisely.
Amongst people. And I think this is not the time to be inactive. This is the time to just think through how you do things and what you do, both in your investing life and in your personal life, to say, okay, what happens if they do bank cash? You know, what do I need to think about? What do I need to think about if you've made some money in your career and you're sitting on savings and you live in the US or Europe and or the UK and wealth taxes are coming and somebody can suddenly tax you 20% in a one-off hit? How do you deal with that?
Well, let's think some of these things through because they're great points and they're the sort of things that everyone's going to be facing, those decisions. I mean, let's start with this idea of banning cash because that is something that the younger generation think is a great idea. I speak to my kids about this. They're like, oh, no cash, be great, fantastic. And they don't understand the implications of that. What should people do to get ahead of a possible ban in cash?
There is only one reason to ban cash.
Right.
And it's all about negative rates.
Of course.
And we've seen it in Switzerland because the Swiss went to negative rates and one of the Swiss Cantonal pension funds rightly said, we're going to take our cash out. So they went to the bank and said, we want to draw X million dollars in cash. And the bank said, no. This is what do you mean? It's our cash. And it's like, well, it's not. You don't seem to have a physical right to the cash, so which is the first stages of the ban of cash. So that meant they couldn't get around negative rates. Okay, so negative rates, 0.5%, 1%. You know, it's not the end of the world. It's a put option price. You know, you're paying for a put option of owning cash. In this environment, I'd pay 1% to own cash. However, it gives them the right to come in the morning and say, oh, deposit rates are now negative 10%, and there's your wealth tax. And those kind of situations are bad. So how do you get around that situation is not easy. Obviously, why do you think people are getting very excited about Bitcoin? It's a way of making cash payments and doing stuff without having to need physical cash. That's helpful because you can at least transfer cash around because they can stop you moving it if that you don't have cash. If it's physical cash, I can give it to you here. If I need to wire you something, the bank can stop me wiring it to you. But Bitcoin gets around some of that. Obviously, you know, we'll talk a bit later about gold, but obviously gold is one of the ways around it because gold doesn't have a negative rate really, or it's relatively small, the cost of carrying gold versus the negative rates of cash. So obviously gold is going to get very attractive. It's not easy for people. So what do you do? I mean, one of the ways that I address this is I want an operating business.
Right.
I want an operating business that generates cash, but you don't want to sit on huge piles of cash. So you need to think that through and what you do if you're lucky enough to have some savings. But operating businesses, at least you've got cash flow turning over, you're doing things, you're growing things, and you're building value for a situation where you can release the cash at some point in the future should you need to.
Well, let's talk about portfolio construction then, because you know the 60-40 traditional, if they're both going to go down, that's 100% of bad news. What are people looking? Because Treasury is obviously, you said quite rightly that the layup trade for the year is to get long Treasuries, to get long AAA collateral, and that's playing out in spades, and it feels like that's going to accelerate. But it, of course, if we see a massive move into that space, which seems like a sensible play, it creates havoc over here. So from a portfolio perspective, what should people be looking at doing?
It's not easy.
No, of course.
It's not easy. Look, you know, bond yields are going to go to 0.5% in the US. They're the wrong price for silver.
When you said that on CNBC, you were on the phone from the Cayman Islands talking, and I was watching the anchor, and her face, she couldn't compute the idea of a 10-year US Treasury at 0.5%. But you look around and you see the Bunds negative, and you see Switzerland negative. You know, these are safe, strong economies and countries. Why is it such a stretch to see that perhaps notionally the safest asset in the world would trade at those rates? It seems
and in a dollar bull market, it's a no-brainer. It's one of the best layup trades I've ever seen, and you get positive carry. You get paid to do the trade. I mean, it's perfect.
But from an equity perspective, because that's where a lot of people.
Well, I'm more interested in the machinations as opposed to you know, what's the right way of doing this in terms of equity. Just think of what a falling bond yield does to pension funds and the insurance companies. It is a massive problem. So they end up, they've taken too much risk in equity, they don't own enough bonds, the bond yield's falling, they can't lock in the annuity rates that they need to do. They're going to have to realize assets, they're going to have to sell assets. I mean, this is going to be a big, big problem. And I don't think people have quite figured out how bad the pension issue is. So it does mean that the equity markets are likely to come under increasing pressure. We know that there's huge pockets of illiquidity because the market is basically now the liquidity providers are the high frequency trading firms. And they just, you know, I'm not going to get into the argument about good or bad, but they're just not built like the banks were to take huge chunks of stock of people and take risk. So we just don't have that. And so that makes it very lopsided risk reward in the equity market.
But if we think about this, and you think about the fact that whether we like it or not, whether they like it or not, this is all going to come down to central banks and what central banks do. They're either going to save this somehow, or they're going to make a misstep like Kuroda did and screw this thing up. But it's going to come from them. To the central banks, optically, when you're trying to manage fear and you're trying to manage reactions, you're trying to herd a lot of people into not doing something crazy, which brings down the system, whatever that means, the equity markets are what you have to target because that's what people understand. If you do something with the bond market, if you correct something that's going wrong in the bond market, it doesn't...
Okay, most people go, okay, so we've seen some of this happen already and people just don't see the signs. Is one of the things the central banks will do is buy chunks of the equity market.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which and mean, if the pension system is at point of collapse, then they will have to find ways of guaranteeing a yield to it or guaranteeing a return. And that's buying equities. Now, that doesn't mean, as we've seen in Japan, doesn't mean equities go up.
No.
And we've seen it, you know, Taiwanese buy equity, the Koreans buy equity, the Chinese have bought equity. You know, it's not unusual. But they'll be a larger owner of the equity market, which is, you know, we're getting in a world that I don't understand anymore, where the biggest owner, well, maybe I do understand. Maybe it's what you and I grew up with in the 70s, where the state owns half the companies. Well, at the end of this, the obvious thing is the state will own half the companies again.
Right. But this time, the difference being they'll do it with printed money.
Yeah. And what does that mean? And this is the argument. Nobody knows. All I know is that, you know, I speak to a lot of people, and some people are sanguine about it. Say, look, it's going to be fine. It'll work out. And maybe they're right. They're at the best case scenario for me. You know, nobody's going, this is going to be boon times, but maybe they'll get through this. But I just think the propensity for a slip up on the banana skin is huge.
Yeah, it's such a hard landing to stick. I mean, you talk about what some people say it's going to be okay. You know, I know that you and I have chatted in the last couple of weeks, and some of the messages you've been getting from people, really savvy, smart, clear-headed, cold-eyed investors who normally in this kind of environment are sitting there going, great, the opportunities that are going to come my way are phenomenal. But the message this time is really different, right?
Yeah, and I've been really careful. I've not gone out and said the world's going to shit. I've been, you know, structured and this is what's happening. This is what I think is happening next. You know, and I've been trying to go through it methodically and using my framework without going, you know what, deep down I think it's all fucked. And what's interesting is some really, really old macro hands, some smart, smart people and very famous guys. I'm getting emails from them saying, you know what, sell everything. No, everything.
Right.
And I'm like, wow. I mean, people are just, you know, in the background saying, we are getting very, very concerned. Now, look, again, we can all be wrong. But again, what they're saying, if you listen to what they're saying, it's not like, yes, it's definitely happening. But what they're saying is the probability of that bad outcome is exploding. And therefore, you have to be really careful. And don't forget, there are worse outcomes in all of this.
Yeah.
You know, the worst outcome is war.
Correct.
And where that, and many people, you know, many sensible people that we've had on Real Vision have said, you know what? The outcome that could be the end of this is war. I don't know, and I don't want to predict that, and I just don't want to think about it. That's quite happy living in the Cayman Islands, hidden away from a lot of the worst problems that are there. It's one of the reasons why the Cayman Islands is such a great place. But yeah, it's troubling.
But again, and that you bring up war, which is this is another interesting point, and it's about the speed with which this wave of, call it realization, call it broadening acceptance, whatever it may be. You know, I gave a presentation almost a year ago to the day, last year, talking about cycles and talking about war as an inevitable part of the cycle. And when I first gave that speech, people afterwards were like, well, you're saying there's going to be a war? And I said, look, no, what I'm saying is there's not going to be a war, which is kind of a little bit nuanced, but I wasn't trying to be a smartass. That's what I was saying. In the year since, the number of smart people who are now very happy to talk about the possibility that we could have a major conflict is ratcheting up really, really fast, which I find very concerning.
And I don't even know what that conflict is. And I don't know what it looks like in the modern era. I know the cyber conflict, which is another huge issue that we'll have to get some more people on Real Vision to talk about because it's a bigger deal than we really realized. I mean, Neil Howe's Fourth Turning, which is something I really, really enjoyed. It speaks to me intuitively about generational cycles, etc. I mean, that's one of the outcomes that he says is reasonably likely. Now, whether that war is an internal conflict, you know, could China go to civil war? Well, I know there's groups in the Pentagon who are gaming that already, because there is an outcome of that. And if the Chinese economy collapses, then what do they do? Does China go outward, which is the case that Germany did, so they become an aggressor? Or do they just get caught in a civil war? What does that mean for the world? I don't know. Does that happen? Well, I don't think so, but it's possible. I don't know. The only thing I do know is in environments like this, it's quick. It's amazing how fast things accelerate.
Yeah.
The banks weren't a problem at all until January the 20th when I wrote the article and suddenly the banks were the biggest problem in the world. It's like, wow, this changes fast. I mean, in a month, some of these have fallen 30%. It's like, okay, look, you know, we cannot deal with the speed of the movements going on right now. And as I've always said is, once the volatility genie starts coming out, the sine waves get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think we're in that phase. I mean, who knows? Maybe we're very, very lucky, but I do not see a way out of one of the big uglies happening.
Well, look, one of the ways out, I guess, for want of a better phrase, but it's a much better segue, is gold. We said we'd talk about gold, so we should probably talk about that because it's something that suddenly, you know, it's up $40 today, it's up 3% today, and people are suddenly starting to pay attention to something that, along with all these other things, you know, as I've kept saying, nothing matters to anybody until it matters to everybody. And that's, I think, the genesis of the speed of these movements. Are we now going to see that in gold?
Well, you see, you have to be very careful with gold, and people who love the gold story are very quick to not strip out the currency move in gold to understand what's the real move. Because gold is a currency and it's a number of other things as well. And you have to understand what's currency move. Now, my guess is if you put gold inverted against dollar yen, it's pretty similar. So it's telling you it's more of a currency move. Okay, that's fine. But technically, it's doing something interesting. And the dollar's not doing that. So there's something broader going on in gold. I think the gold chart is a giant wedge pattern. And it's been trading in a channel, and I think that channel is breaking, which is the first move I was looking for. So great. I think the next thing we will see is as the dollar rallies again, which I think it will, I think gold will fail to make a new low. That's the signal you're looking for. If gold is dollar's rallying and gold fails to make a new low, then something has changed. And that something changing is the nuance we need. And if it is, I use something in Global Macro Invest called the GMI crash pattern, which is basically a failed rally. So the market comes from a high, falls, rallies, and then takes out that low, and that's the signal. that fail pattern works in reverse as well. So if gold does that, so it fails to take out the recent low on the next big gold dollar move, and I think this is how it plays out. In my mind, my framework is, and I could be wrong, but I see it relatively clearly, is the dollar keeps going up. I know everybody doesn't believe it. Virtually nobody believes the dollar's going to go up in a negative rate environment. I don't think you even believe it. So I'm one of the few people who believe it, and I could be dead wrong. But I believe that the dollar continues to go up in a negative rate environment. They continue to cut interest rates in the early 80s, and the dollar went up 100%. They continue to cut interest rates in the 90s, and in the late 90s, and the dollar went up 50%. So I think the probability is, if the Fed are going to negative rates, the rest of the world is in total chaos. In which case, I see the dollar as the primary currency asset. However, in negative rates, the primary currency asset will be gold.
Yeah.
It'll just outperform the dollar. The dollar will be the next best currency. Because there's going to be a dawning, particularly, it's going to come out of the family office space first. Because they're in wealth preservation mode. And the first thing they're going to think is, okay, negative rates, what do I do? You know, if you do have a certain amount of wealth and you've got negative rates, they will not stand for that. But you cannot invest in markets in it because the markets are too volatile. So you have to buy gold.
Well, look, it answers, for a family office, it answers almost every problem they face.
Yeah, but it also, you know, as we've got to be intellectually honest about it, it was a pain in the ass to own in the last 5 years.
Oh, hell yeah.
But many of the family offices who believe in gold have had it for a long time, since the 300s. So they don't really care about it. It's the other level of wealth that needs to figure this out. They won't come until later because they won't figure it out. But there will be some people that will start to move the price that start to understand, if we're here, we're going to get to here. The whole key to the investment games we talked about when we first started this interview is, it's the anticipation of the events is where you make the money. You can't wait for the events and then look around you. The rising probability means that the price of gold has to go higher. I mean, maybe the easy way right now is forget all the buying of physical gold. You've got plenty of time to do that before all of that doesn't work. What you can do is just buy some call options and then not worry about it for the time being. You know, that's how I structured it for Global Macro Investor. I sold 1 year downside puts, saying I'm happy to buy if it falls down to 1,000. And I'll buy, with that money, I'll buy three times as many way out of the money calls. So if it really starts to go, I'm in it. And then I can figure all the stuff out later about, okay, I want to get physical gold, where do I want to do it, all of that. And I know we've got some interviews coming up about that physical gold thing, because we've got a gold storage here in the Cayman. Not we got a gold storage, but there is a gold storage in the Cayman Islands that's relatively interesting. Yeah, I think it's coming. I don't think I want to jump the gun yet.
What's it, you said something that's interesting, because we've been talking about the speed with which all this stuff happens. When it starts to happen, it really starts to happen. We've seen it in the banks, we've seen it in equity markets cascading lower. And yet you said, buy the calls, play it through options, because you've got plenty of time to buy this before it happens. Which is interesting, because what we're talking about in markets is, let's face it, a limitless supply of scrip. What we're talking about with gold is a physically very limited supply.
Yeah, but you're thinking, you're approaching this with the person with the knowledge. The person without the knowledge is much later to the game.
Right.
So the price gaps, the really big price gaps, where it moves 10% a day, 15% in a day, are not here yet.
No, they're away.
And that's the point, is you know where it is because you understand the gold market. But other people have to come into this, and it has to dawn on them. They have to realize, they have to go further down those steps to realize, oh yeah, maybe I need to get gold. And that's really going to be a price much higher than here, probably when it breaks the big wedge pattern. So there's the small channel, then there's the big wedge, which is much higher up, 1600 or wherever it is. And at that point, then everyone's going to go, oh yeah, now. And then you get the big price gaps.
Okay, so look, let's wrap this up. We've taken up enough of everybody's time with all this gloom and doom, but what should people be looking at? Like right now, what's the things that you've got on your Bloomberg screen that you think people should be paying most attention to?
Yeah, so there's a number of things. Firstly, obviously, it's the dollar. And you need to look at a broad range. Don't use the DXY because it's useless. I use it just because it's easy to show people. I have a broad range of currencies. Understand what's happening with the dollar. Understand what's happening in the oil market. It's less necessary now because it's made its massive move. I think keep an eye on the share price of those illiquidity providers, BlackRock, etc. Keep your price on the European banks. Use SX7P, I think is the European bank sector. You can use that, or you can look at one of the individual banks, whether it's Santander, Banco Popular, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, you take your pick, Standard Chartered. There's a whole load of them that look like they're going to zero. So keep your eye on those. Obviously, just the 10-year bond in the US is a pretty useful place to start. Glance at how negative other bond markets are becoming in terms of yields. And then I think there's still stress, more stress to come from emerging markets, so EEM. And I think just keep those things on your screen, monitor them. I think of all, it's the banks right now that we need to follow. And I don't think people have yet, the penny's not dropped about these liquidity providers. That'll be the one where everyone's going to, oh my God, these are too big to fail, but they're private companies and only the rich are going to get hosed because that's who owns it. And they might let some of these things go. I mean, BlackRock is the largest owner of property in America, of housing. You know, I don't know how this ends, but it's not good.